Welcome to The Plain Truth, a show where we discover some of the answers to mysteries and questions and anomalies in the world around us. Every week we look into these things, and this week we have a special guest, Calvin Howard, also known as Sikh Virta. He's quite well known in the Ormus and white powder gold and sun gazing communities. And so, without any further ado, Calvin, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. Glad to hear it. Along for the ride, we have a few guests this week. Oolong Rabbit. Oolong, are you there?
I'm here, guys.
Daddy Bob?
Yeah, Daddy Bob here.
And Uriel?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, well, thanks everyone for joining us. And so let's get started. So, Calvin, I thought a good place to start would be a little bit of your background and how you got into all this. Should we start with sun gazing? I think that's what might have been the beginning of some of this.
Yes. I'd say about 1975 or six, I did some reading and I got interested in sun gazing. And I began sun gazing, you know, just independently, not with any group or anything. And this was actually in Memphis, Tennessee. And I was living there at that time, had a small business that was operating, and began getting up early in the morning and looking at the sun. And I found that over time, my whole body began to change, and my whole attitude began to change, which I could only attribute to the increasing amounts of sunlight that I was taking in. And I now, having done it for a long, long time, realize what was actually happening. But just before I closed my business and took a job international consulting in Saudi Arabia, I had gotten up to the point where I could look at the sun for, say, 30, 40 minutes at a time without problem. And when you get to what I call the avid sun gazing or extreme sun gazing phases of your experience, really big changes begin to happen in your attitude. And I noticed these things happening to me. And I can recall one experience where I shocked a good many people. And this is where, just prior to going to Arabia, they had an eclipse of the sun. And at that time, I was living in San Diego. This was about 1991 or 91. And it was a full eclipse, first time it had happened in that part of California in, I don't know, many, many years. And, of course, you know, the television was broadcasting and the radio was broadcasting, do not look at the sun. Do not look at the sun. And, of course, being an experienced sun gazer at that time, I had been doing it for 5 or 6 years, I didn't regard the warnings. And I stood out in a parking lot with a good number of other people who all had, you know, various devices to watch the sun eclipse. And there I was, you know, broad-faced, looking directly at the sun. And I thought people were going to tackle me and hurt me because they kept saying, don't look at the sun, don't look at the sun. But I stood there and was able to watch the entire eclipse of the sun for about 45 minutes and without any problems at all. And then that was proof to me that, you know, you could develop your eyes in such a way that the sun will not harm you. But, you know, it's something that people need to be careful with if they're beginners, because you can temporarily harm your retinas if they're not prepared for the increased and intense light that you're bringing in. So there, you know, I've taught many people how to do this, and it's quite simple, and it's a life-changing experience. In 91, I went to Saudi Arabia to do international consulting work, and I actually lived there for a total of 8 years. But when I first got to Saudi Arabia, I was there on single status, and so, you know, I was able to do this more unencumbered, I would say, by family or other things going on, because there's not much to do in Saudi Arabia when you're a man there on single status. So I developed a regimen there, which further increased my ability to intake sunlight. But the latitude I was at and the intensity of the sun in the desert was surprising to me. There's virtually no air pollution there. And so the sky is quite clear. You know, it's one of those places where you go out in the desert at night there and you can see the sky and the billions of stars. You know, I live in Hong Kong now, and there's so much light pollution here, we can see about 10 or 12 stars at night. That's it, because of, you know, the light pollution from the city. But in Saudi Arabia, where I was, it was very, very clear. And I began a regimen of looking at the sun for an hour before I went to work, and then an hour at lunch, which is 12 noon, and then an hour at sunset. I was on the edge of the Red Sea, so every evening after work, I would go down to the Red Sea, sit on a rock, which became my perch for over a year, every day, and watch the sunset. And every morning, on that flat desert, you could see the sun from the very beginning of the sunrise. And then during my lunch hour, rather than eat lunch, I would, I had a chaise lounge type lawn chair that I would lay in and watch the sun directly overhead for an hour. So I was sun gazing about 3 hours a day, which is, most people would call that quite extreme. And I fully began to understand why the ancient Egyptians and the ancient Essenes had three names for the sun. And I understand it quite a bit more now after many years of doing this, that, you know, it's sun at noonday, they called the Most High God. And that that is certainly true. But, you know, I mean, today I'm 67 years old, and I don't require glasses. My sun gazing has increased my vision. Before I started doing it, I had corrective lenses, but now I don't even need them. And, you know, as a person ages, their eyes usually start to weaken. And I would say that, you know, from time to time, I do need to read. I use a slight increased magnification, but no corrective lenses are required. If the print is really small, I do have a pair of 0.15 or something magnifiers that I use to read the very small print. But otherwise, you know, I have perfect vision, better than my kids even. And so as far as damaging one's eyes, I would say that, you know, that's not to be a concern if you gradually increase your ability over time to sun gaze. And one thing I would add, though, is I did have one scary experience right after I got to Saudi Arabia. And it was because, I guess, of the different latitude that I had been used to in longitude and the brightness of the sun. I mean, sometimes it would get up to 50 degrees centigrade or 130 degrees in the daytime. And when you're sun gazing with a sun that's that intense, you do need to take extra precautions. But right after first arriving there, I would say within the first 2 or 3 months, I began just intensive sun gazing, and I forgot to keep my eyes moved. And I stared for, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes directly at the sun without moving my eyes at all. And all of a sudden I realized when I, you know, closed my eyes and then reopened them that I couldn't see. I had these really large bluish, greenish orbs in my eyesight, which, you know, I thought I was blind. And it scared me out of my wits. But over time, and I would say, you know, I was meditating and praying, oh, God, please don't let me be blind. And then I realized over time, you know, the next day, that big blue circle was reduced, you know, about 10 or 20%. The next day, it was like 40% gone. The third or fourth day, you know, by the fifth day, it was totally, eyesight was totally corrected. And so, you know, I guess my prayer was answered or whatever. But what I also realized then, too, was that I could see better than I ever had before. When they corrected themselves, I was able to see the auras around plants. And I was able to see the auras around animals. And I was able to see the auras around people that I was looking at. You know, you could see the rainbow colors and auras of the people that you were speaking with. And that was a very interesting thing. Now, later, I did some research into sun gazing, and I found this guy by the name of, some writing from the guy by the name of Gustav Fechner, who was a German psychiatrist and medical doctor who tried experimenting with sun gazing back in the late 1800s. He eventually wrote three or four books about it, one about angels, because, you know, he had a similar experience where he thought he had gone blind by exposing his retinas to the sun to a very extensive degree. And for several days, he was blinded. And then over time, his eyes corrected, and he was able to see angels. He saw the auras, but he also saw what he called heavenly beings, you know, in the room with him from time to time. And he wrote a book about it. So people want to research this, look up Gustav Fechner, F-E-C-H-N-E-R. And so I can relate quite a bit to the experiences that he had. But what I would say is, you know, most people are very afraid of sun gazing. But as long as you gradually build up your eyesight to intake more and more sunlight, then you won't have a problem. I've always kind of been an impetuous type, so I probably pushed it more than most people do. You know, I've heard people say increase it by 10 seconds every day. Or, you know, maybe 1 minute or 2 minutes a day. I would do, you know, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. I made bigger jumps, but it hasn't affected my eyes at all. So that.
Well, a couple of questions from this. I mean, it's fascinating to hear that, those experiences. I mean, kind of on a mundane level, I'm wondering, did your eyesight stay essentially better? I mean, even if you quit doing it, was it more or less cured?
You mean now?
Well, let's say you're not, I mean, you're living in Hong Kong, and it's probably a lot harder to do it there, and let's say you don't do it so much, but your eyesight didn't get worse. It didn't revert back to before.
No, it's stayed better. And, you know, from time to time, I would say now that I'm in my, you know, middle or later 60s. Once in a while, I get up in the morning, maybe I hadn't had a full night's sleep, and my eyes seem a bit cloudy or whatever. All I have to do is go out, look at the sun for 5 or 10 minutes, and my my eyesight becomes excellent almost immediately. And that's become the regimen I do now. You know, if I feel like my eyes are weaker at any given point, and they do because I do an awful lot of reading and I'm on the internet a lot, so I'm looking at these monitors probably far more than I should. And that does have an effect on your eyes. But going outside for 10 or 15 minutes and looking into the sun corrects that almost immediately. And I would say to people that, you know, in the early days, you know, I did extensive sun gazing, like up to 3 hours a day. Now I can accomplish what I used to accomplish in 3 hours in about 15 or 20 minutes. And so I don't need to do it as much as I used to because my body's accustomed to it. And I can, you know, almost immediately look directly into the sun without a problem. And I use a few various devices now also. I learned by studying the ancient Aztecs and the Viracochans that the sun priests of of South and Central America, they used mirrors, which actually gives you a reverse image of the sun, which actually gives you what we would call moonlight. And so by alternating between direct sun gazing and mirrored sun gazing, you get both sides, I'll say. And
Now you've got me curious. How would that be moonlight? What does moonlight mean?
Well, the moon only reflects the sun. And from an alchemical standpoint, you get the reversed light because it's a mirrored reflection. When you look at the moon at night, when you look at the full moon, you're getting a reverse reflection of sunlight. And you can accomplish the same thing with a mirror. Now, the sun priests of ancient America, they used gold, polished gold, finely polished gold. And I have such a mirror that I use. I had it made while I was in Saudi Arabia so that I could get reflected sunlight.
And what are the effects? How does this differ from just normal sun gazing?
It just broadens, I believe, broadens your receptivity and also gives you a different aspect. And you know, I'm into getting the full aspect, both positive and negative. If you want to look at it from the yin-yang aspect, then the reversed or reflected light is the yin, whereas the direct sunlight is the yang. So if you want a full complement of both the yin and the yang, then you would use reflected sunlight.
What would happen if you just went out and did moon gazing? Did you get any benefits from that?
I'm sure there are some benefits, but I would say they're probably quite slight. You can act as your own moon by using a mirror. Or,
okay.
You know, the surface of a crystal will do the same thing. Some people do that because, and then they'll wear the crystal because the crystal will retain a lot of the frequencies of light that come to it while you're sun gazing, and then you can retain that and wear it next to your body. That will help as well.
By the way, when you do this, do you need to be barefooted?
I live in a concrete jungle, and it's very, very difficult to find earth to ground yourself on, but I try to ground myself at least once a day. But it's best.
Well, for example, when you were in Saudi Arabia, did you?
I would put my feet in the sand on the edge of the Red Sea, and that gives you a much more balanced reception, I would say, of the light because you're grounded. You know, you actually act as a conduit between the sun and the earth, and so to ground yourself. And I know there are some people that will tell you that always do it when you're grounded. That's not totally necessary, but grounding yourself from time to time is important. To walk on the earth or walk on sand, put your feet in water on the earth is a good thing, like at the edge of the beach or something, or in the lake. That's a good way to do it as well.
And did you, in the, I guess you might say like the orgone world, people sometimes use their eyes to break up clouds. Did you ever do that? You ever stare at clouds to make them go away?
Yes, I've done that. I found some very interesting things happen. And this has to do with the changing nature of your spirit and your soul as you become more and more an avid sun gazer. And that is your whole deportment actually changes. It softens you. And we'll get into why that happens a bit later, but because it's an alchemical effect that's actually going on in your body. I will say that I can fully understand St. Francis of Assisi, who, by the way, was canonized by the church many years after his death. But he didn't live in Assisi. He was from there, but he lived in North Africa, in Egypt, and he was one of what they called the Desert Fathers. And he was noted as to having animals follow him everywhere he went. And I found that also happens to me. When you're an avid sun gazer, and I'm sure St. Francis was too, that, I'm often followed by birds. If I go on my roof, for example, and sun gaze here in Hong Kong, I mean, birds come to the trees around me, few as they are. But whenever I'm out sun gazing, the birds come around. And I had that happen in Saudi Arabia, too. I mean, I used to go out into the desert 50 or 60 miles from the next person. I mean, long way out there. And I would camp out over the weekend by myself. And I would always try to find a place where there was a sacred spring and a sacred tree. I made them sacred by dedicating them to the service of this work I was doing. And whenever I would wake up in the morning, the tree was covered with birds. Now, where they came from in the middle of the desert, I don't know. But when I was there, the birds would come. And I found that, whenever I was out sun gazing, little animals and little birds would all come around. I thought that was great. I loved it.
Well, I'm envious. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Well, I think the little animals, they are sun gazers. I mean, the little birds, when they get up in the morning, they're waiting for the sun. They tweet and twerp and like the cock that crows in the morning. They are just so pleased and blessed, and they recognize that with their tweeting and their singing, and they wait for the sun. When I'm out there with them, I think they recognize a kindred spirit, and that's been my experience with little animals.
Well, there's kind of a virtuous cycle, the idea of sonic bloom, if you've heard of that, for the kind of like by having natural sounds early in the morning and a little mist, it makes all kinds of plants and trees very, very happy, and they grow fast and so on. And probably applies to us, too. It would make us all healthier.
there's a communication that goes on in all of nature. And I think when you're sun gazing, and especially when you have become an avid sun gazer and do it for, extended periods of time during the day, that your actual aura and your own spirit expands, and you actually become lighter. And I think the animals recognize that in us. In other words, it's a way of communication, that it's from spirit to spirit. You know, I've even called birds. What I mean by that is I would, you know, have an intention where I wish some birds would come. And all of a sudden, here comes three or four of them and land close to me. So I don't know. I mean, I guess there's an instantaneous communication in all things in nature when you're doing that. So I would say that it's part of the alchemical change that comes to you when you're an avid sun gazer.
Makes sense. Daddy Bob, you got a question?
Yeah. Calvin, I've got three questions, and I want to start with the easy stuff first. Back when I was on the ORMA sun gazing list with you, which I'm still on, at that time...
I haven't participated much in that. Sorry, I'm just so busy.
Oh, I understand. At that time, you had indicated that evening sun gazing or sunset sun gazing was better for health purposes, and at that time, I was able to use that to overcome my seasonal affective disorder or the winter blues. I was able to completely cure it. I never had it again. Would you comment on that?
Yes. The light comes in a spectrum as the Earth rotates, and I don't know how many people are into astrology, but I have gotten more and more into it because I understand now the importance of the light and its different phases. You know, the original zodiac, or let's say the oldest one which we have, which was in the Dendera temple in Egypt, you know, the Egyptians identified the 12 signs of the zodiac. There's actually more than 12, but the 12 main ones. And they knew that, you know, Aries began at 6 a.m. and it lasted for 2 hours. That's when the Earth rotates 30 degrees. And so from 6 till 8, it's Aries. And then from 8 till 10, it's Taurus. And what the differentiation is a different frequency of light. In the morning, you get the ultraviolet spectrum, the finest light, what I call the spiritual light, comes in the morning. Now, afternoon, and you know, every 2 hours, the sign of the light, let's say the zodiacal sign of the light, changes all through the night as well. But, you know, what the Masons call the Royal Arch is the first 7 signs of the zodiac in its rounds, and that's what you get during the daylight hours of the zodiac. So
what are we getting
after Libra? After Libra, the night comes on, and so I mean, there's a great association between astrology and the light. Now, the physical light is in the evening. What I mean by that, you go from the infrared, from the ultraviolet, all through the day. It's changing slightly. Past noon, you then start to get the infrared spectrum. So in the afternoon, the red light is physical. In the morning, before noon, it's spiritual. The 2 hours between, let's say, 12 and 2, there's a transition going on. You get both physical and spiritual light. But in the evening, like when you're watching the sun go down, that's almost totally infrared. And that is physical. Your blood is red. Your skin is red. These all have to do with the physical aspects of the body. Morning is for the spirit. Afternoon is for the body.
Okay. Next question, and this is more involved. At that time, I was very busy raising a family and running a business and just couldn't get out in the morning and do the morning sun gazing. And you suggested to me at that time to turn my face to the sun at about 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock in the morning with my eyelids closed. And I did that, and I had something to me that was profound, and it still goes on. What I began to see was I would see a gathering from all corners of my vision of tiny suns. And then they would form a circle, and they would go in counterclockwise, and it would be like the tiger turning into butter, you know, in the old tale. And it would turn into a bright magenta circle. And then all of a sudden it would explode, and all the tiny little suns would just go in every which way out of my vision. Now, that still happens to some extent, but not nearly as much as it did back then. No one has ever been able to explain to me what I'm seeing. Have you got any comment?
Yes. What I would, I can't remember the, you know, the essence of our older discussions, but, you know, a lot of people have very difficult time with the early morning sunlight, because let me tell you, when the sun first breaks in dawn, you can watch it for a few minutes, but it then gets extremely white. The light is, it's actually the ultraviolet spectrum that you're getting the most of. And it's very intense. And most people who have, you know, are couch potatoes and they sit inside all the time and they don't get much sunlight, this is very intense. And besides that, I mean, the sunlight will clear out the darkness that was that's in you. You know, I mean, it goes back to the scripture, I guess, where Christ was saying, you know, if thine eye be single, then your body will be full of light. But if it's not, then your body will be filled of with darkness. And whoa, how much is that darkness? It's something to that effect. But the most people are filled with darkness. And so to encounter that intensive spiritual light early in the morning is very, very rough on them. You know, that's why you have to do it quite gradually. But getting back to your question about closing your eyes and looking at the sun, I was probably recommending that if you have difficulty with the early morning sunlight, you can still get the sunlight, because the ultraviolet will penetrate your eyelids. And what you're seeing is light through your eyelids. Now, whenever light strikes the retina, it creates these phogenes or phosgenes in your vision. And these are those little spots that you're seeing. And, you know, the more you take in the light, the less they will be. I don't have any anymore and haven't had for quite some time. But in the early days, I can remember, you know, you get these spots in your eyes, and they can be any number of colors. And those colors, you should actually write this stuff down and record it, because it'll be of later use to you. But these various spots of color tell you something about yourself, because the colors, you know, the chromatic scale of colors, they all have meaning also. You know, if you look at the rainbow, it goes from infrared to ultraviolet, or from ultraviolet to infrared. And those will be the colors of the phosgenes that you see in the light, or in your retina as a result of light. And that tells you something about your physical being.
The fact that these would gather and go in a counterclockwise circle. Okay, I have seen my brow chakra many times, and it seems to correspond to the spinning of the brow chakra and the size of the brow chakra. Would you comment as to any relevance that may have to the third eye and the brow chakra?
Well, the crown chakra is white light, and therefore it contains all the light. Okay, white light has all of the colors in them. If you look at a chakra chart, you'll see that, you know, it starts from infrared at the bottom, and it goes all the way up to ultraviolet. This is corresponding to your body and the chakras in your body. So the light is telling you where you need to do the work. If you look at the colors, because, you know, most people, when they first start sun gazing, they are not aware that they're full of darkness. But the sun will tell you where you need to work. I mean, if you see a lot of red splotches, you know you need to work on the lower chakras. If you see lighter and lighter and lighter, or the greens, and, you know, the middle chakra is green, the crown chakra is ultraviolet and turns to white on the top crown chakra. So these are indications to you. The sun will speak to you. There are messages in the sunlight. And we need to learn how to read them and understand them. And that will come through, you know, the more and more sun gazing that you do will actually tell you a lot of things about yourself that you need to be doing and working on. I hope that answers that.
Did you meditate?
Do I meditate? Absolutely. Sun gazing is, in fact, meditation.
Right. Now, here's the question. When you were doing the intensive period in Saudi Arabia, did you add with it meditation, or do you recommend? How do you recommend a kind of balance with this?
Well, this is what I used to do. You know, there's another scripture that where we're instructed, don't pray in public. You know, retire to your closet and be there alone, okay? And prayer, you know, the translation of the word actually means meditation. So we're instructed, I think, from Christ to, you know, do this alone. And so what I used to do is, after sun gazing extensively, I would go into a totally, absolutely dark place and sit in the dark. And believe it or not, you can test how much light you have in your body. And I used to do that, you know, because to me the instruction was fill your body with light. And so when you close your eyes in a dark room, I call it a dark retreat. And I've even done that a few times here in Hong Kong. Is after extensive sun gazing, just go into the darkest place you can find, a closet or whatever, and shut all the light out totally. And then you can actually test how much light is in your body, because when you close your eyes, you will see the sun inside of yourself.
That sounds interesting. How do you see the sun inside of yourself? Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, you know, you have a third eye. The pineal gland is a collector of light. It's got a curtain hanging around it. And I forget the name of it, something vellum. But, you know, it's the temple. Like the ancient Israelites were taught how to build the temple. Well, actually, that's talking about the temple inside your brain or inside your head. And so that light is the Christ entity within you. And so when you close your eyes after extensive sun gazing, you will have a lot of light inside your head, and you can see it. You know, it's like somebody flipped on the switch. I guess, is that answering your question?
Well, to some extent, I think, in a way, you just need to do these things. They're experiential kind of things. So
yes,
it's
all about self-learning. But what I'm saying is, in the dark retreat, that is extending your meditation. You take in the light, and then you dark, and then you go into the dark place, and you can actually test the amount of light that's in your body. You know, lots of times I could not sleep because, you know, when I closed my eyes, it was just as bright inside my skull as it was when I was out in the bright sunlight, because the light will stay in you. It gradually will move down to the solar plexus. But in the beginning, it's inside your head as well. And this was our instruction. You know, the Ancient Essenes taught this as well. And I hold it that Jesus was actually an Essene. He was a sun gazer. When he went to the wilderness, out to the desert, you know, he didn't fast and pray. He sun gazed. He didn't need to eat. And he meditated.
That brings up another question. Some people say that if you sun gaze, you don't need to eat very much.
Yeah, well, these are the breatharian types. And, you know, there's various ideas on that. I do know that I lost 40 pounds when I first started sun gazing extensively in Saudi Arabia because I just had no desire to eat. I was a bit overweight when I first went there. And after doing sun gazing for almost a year, 3 hours a day, you know, my body received all the energy it needed. I didn't need to have energy from food. And so I just existed basically on liquids. I fasted for more than 90 days at one point where I didn't eat anything for 90 days. And I was the healthiest I've ever been in my life. So I would say that, you know, if you do that totally, which is very difficult to do in our complex societies today, but you could exist entirely on sunlight if you wanted to. There's many people in the past who have done it. I can verify that it can be done because I've done it. And but you'll find also that... you know, one of the greatest cultural social activities that people do is when they sit down and have a meal together. So if you're a person that doesn't require eating, you're going to lose a lot of your friends.
that raises another point I wanted to bring up, Kelvin, and maybe Plain would know about her, but there's a Japanese woman named Mayuki Hatoyama. I think she was the wife of the, I'm not sure if it's the current or the former prime minister of Japan. And one of the claims that she made is that she gains energy by actually eating sunlight. Have you ever heard of that practice?
Well, yes, that's what the breatharians do. And sun gazing is actually a part of the practice of that. But it also requires a regimen of proper breathing. Most of us don't really know how to breathe. And, I found... You know, even in Saudi Arabia, where the relative humidity was like 12 to 13 or 14%, you know, you can, by proper breathing techniques while you're sun gazing, you can actually extract the moisture that's in the air you breathe, so that you don't even require water or liquids. Now, yet I would caution people to be extremely careful with that. Because unless you know what you're doing, and I'm not an expert on it, but I do know that with proper breathing techniques, like, you know, breathing in properly, using your diaphragm to assist you in the breathing, and then holding the breath in, that your lungs will actually extract any moisture that's in the air that you breathe, and that water will be retained in your body, and then you breathe out dry air. But it takes a lot of practice, and people need to know what they're doing before they, you know, do that.
Just a sort of a technical question. When you do this practice, do you have the eyelids sort of like half open as you do some of the meditation techniques?
You mean my sun gazing?
Yeah, or do you have them wide open?
I have them wide open.
Okay. All right.
Now, what I will do sometimes, depending on the intensity of the sunlight, is I will do what I call the 40 days and 40 nights, and what that is I sun gaze with one eye, and hold my hand over the other, and then I count to 40, and then I'll switch eyes so that, you know, it's pretty severe sometimes, and I found this out in Saudi Arabia that. You know, both eyes wide open directly into the sun you get a tremendous amount of light. Now, you have to also understand that you have one positive eye and one negative eye. I mean, you know, everything that comes in twos, one is positive, one is negative, and your eyes are the same. That means that you have a receiver and a sender. You know, you can test to see which is your stronger eye, but whichever one is your stronger eye is your sending eye. And whichever one is your weaker eye is your receiving eye. So you are actually in communication with the sun. When you're sun gazing, you have a right eye and a left eye. You know, you're sending out your thoughts, your intentions, whatever, into the sun. And then the sun is going to answer you, and then you receive it with your receiving eye. And so, you know, messages are being transmitted whenever you're sun gazing. So I would break that up into sending only for a time and then receiving only for a time.
Now, I know in some of the Qigong systems, you know, one side of the body is yin, one side is yang, and then in males and females, the two sides are perfect. Is there any type of thing like that as males or females, any difference, or would you say it's just the individual?
Well, I'm saying that you have a positive and negative tie. Some people say that the negative is the female and the positive is the male. I don't know whether that's true or not. I actually believe that the right side, let's say, you know, everything in the Bible says Christ is on the right hand of the Father. It's always talking about the room on the right, the door on the right. You know, actually, I think that's the female side. In other words, I think society has it reversed.
Why do you think that?
Huh?
Why do you think that?
I think that because I think ultimate deity is Sophia, which is wisdom, and Sophia is female, and she occupies the right side of the brain. She's in the cerebrum on the right side, and that is the ultimate Eden. Which would mean that the left side would be, therefore, male. Or the left room of the cerebrum.
Okay.
That's just my own personal opinion. I've only come to that, let's say, in the last 4 or 5 years.
Well, I don't know. Let's move on a little bit. Daddy Bob, you got another question?
Yeah. One more question about these things that I was seeing when I would look up at the sun with my eyes closed. This only happened one time, but it was very vivid. I saw a lattice work. It was a very classic architectural type of lattice work. I saw it in my vision with my eyes closed. It was magenta red, and no one has ever been able to tell me what I saw. I never saw it again, but I did do some reading one time that indicated that I might have seen something to do with sacred geometry, the lattice work of reality. Would you comment on anything about that?
Yeah, well, you know, doing sun gazing, I've had a number of what they would call, I guess mainstream would call it out-of-body experiences, where you actually basically leave your body. And I've seen myself below from way above. And I would say that there is a sacred geometry to all creation. And from above, you can see some of it. I don't know if you're familiar with the work of, Nassim Haramein?
I've tried to keep up with him a bit.
Yeah, well, you know, he's saying that what you're actually seeing is the vacuum in space, which is in the 64-sided tetrahedron. And I know that's true because I've seen it. I've been up there with it. And, you know, you try to explain this to people, they don't know what you're talking about. They think you're some kind of wacko or crazy, but let me tell you, it exists. And, you know, as I've always said that there are messages in the light. And therefore, you need to be aware that you are going to be receiving messages. And the only true language is basically mathematical, which is geometrical. And so when you see these various patterns, I would, you know, I used to have a notebook when I would go sun gazing, and I would kind of draw some of the patterns I saw, and then study them and see what in the world am I being told here? What am I, you know, what instruction is this for me? And so let me just say that these are messages to you, Daddy Bob. And you need to kind of draw them, write them down, and study what you feel their meaning is for you. Because somebody's trying to tell you something.
Okay. Interesting what you said about math and geometry. I just recently heard a quote that said that mathematics is a language and it can lie, but geometry cannot lie.
Well, maybe that's your message.
Okay.
Because, you know, I mean, speaking of that, I didn't mean that to be, you know, flippant or humorous in any way. What I mean by that is, you know, we all have different experiences and we all have different outlooks on our life, and we also have different plans and all this, but we all are here for our own singular purpose. And so, you know, what you see may not be what I see. And so as you go through your life and you get these various messages, you will be prompted, as I am so often. You know, I will see something or hear something or read something as a result of sun gazing. Thoughts will come to me while I'm sun gazing, and then I make a note of it. That's why I say it's always good to have a notebook with you, so you can write down these instantaneous thoughts that come to you, because they're extremely important to you, because the sunlight will stimulate your highest thoughts, and those thoughts are important to you. You need to write these things down and then do the research, because somebody's trying to tell you something.
Okay. All right. I understand.
Hey, Uriel, have you got any questions?
I don't know if I really have any questions. He's covered all the things I had questions about already. So I think I'm kind of left in a state of wonderment at the wisdom of this man. I have had experience with sun gazing and with not eating because of sun gazing, and I was interested that he'd had pretty much the same experience.
Well, my experience is so limited, but it, even just being in the sun, not sun gazing, but just being in the sun makes me want to eat less. I don't know if others have that experience.
Well, that's true, because the sun is the ultimate energy. I mean, it's feeding your skin cells as well. So, I mean, you do have a tendency to eat less when you have a lot of sunlight coming into you, whether it be on the surface or whether the skin surface, or whether or not you're actually intaking it into your body through light. And let me say a little bit about that, which is something I haven't yet covered, and that is that, getting back to this idea that we have these power centers or chakras within our body, you know, and I've learned this since I've been doing a lot of alchemy, and that is that that everything that's going on in nature is an alchemical process, including your own life and growth and development. These are alchemical processes going on, and let me preface that by saying that, you know, when you eat a steak or when you eat vegetables or when you eat a baked potato or whatever, you know, after you've eaten it, it tasted good, but then you kind of forget about it. But your body will perform an alchemical process on that food, and it will extract the essences that your body needs from that food and trash the rest, throw the rest away. So what's going on in your body is an alchemical process. Now, those seven chakras follow the alchemical process also, and you'll notice that in any laboratory where they're doing alchemy, they have a retort, and that retort has a source of heat under it. And the sun, by the way, is our alchemical furnace. Those people who do not get sunlight, they're not going to be very strong, and they're not going to be very healthy, because in order for us to increase this alchemical process that's going on in our own body and in our own growth and development, we need a source of furnace. Every alchemist has a furnace of some kind of a heat source. Now, the sun is the human body's heat source, and that heat and energy is stored in the center chakra. It's right in the middle. It's called the solar plexus. I've tried for years and years and years to discover who named this thing. Where did the name solar plexus come from? And I can't find out. It's just always been called that. I mean, since the time of the ancient Greeks and beyond in ancient history, this particular area, which is just above the navel, is the solar plexus. And, you know, one of the things I learned when I was extensively sun-gazing is when I'd lay in my chaise lounge, say, at noon, and gaze at the sun for an hour, when I'd come back in, I would feel like I had done 100 sit-ups, because my solar plexus was just aching, like I had been exercising extensively. And I hadn't done anything. I just laid there. But what happens is when you take in sunlight into your eyes, you know, it goes into the optic chiasma. And there's, you know, the chiasma is like clasped hands, which encircle the pineal gland. But there's a direct conduit from the pineal gland directly to the solar plexus. And that's where the energy of the sun is stored in your body, is in the solar plexus. And by the way, you know, lots of research has been done in the last 25 years on the solar plexus itself, and it contains brain matter. I mean, there are neurons, brain cells in the solar plexus. It's a second brain. We actually have three brains in the body. One of them is in the solar plexus. The other is in Leo, which is the heart. There are brain cells in the heart as well. So we've got, remember that there is a law of three in nature. Everything comes in three. And so we have three brains in our body. The second largest brain in the body is the solar plexus. And that is the alchemical furnace for our body. If we don't get enough sunlight through our eyes that has been transmitted down to that middle chakra, then we're going to be lacking in health and in development and in spirituality. So it's extremely important that we understand the alchemical process that's going on in the body. And the alchemical furnace, or the human body, which the ancients called, the human body was the retort of the alchemists.
Calvin, I think there's a connection in the vagus nerve that goes from the eyes down into the solar plexus.
Yes. But it's, you know, the word vagrant comes from that. It means it's a wanderer. But all the organs of the body and every other part of the body, they all complex, or they all plexus in the solar plexus. The only difference from that in our cranial brain is the cranial brain is white matter covered with gray matter. In the solar plexus, it's gray matter covered with white matter. It's like the reverse. It's the yin and the yang.
Fascinating stuff. Hey, Calvin, I got another question. Do you think the sun has been changing? It seems to me that, let's say, 30, 40 years ago when I was younger and I looked at it, it seemed to be yellow. And now it looks like it's white all the time.
Yes, you are exactly correct. There's many changes going on in the sun. I've been able to notice them as they've happened. And I do take notice. Yeah, maybe 15 years ago, it started to change drastically. And from that yellowish color that we always had, it's now totally white. And I think that speaks of what's happening in the greater universe around us. There are influences that we don't really understand or know about, and it also has to do with the progression of our solar system in reference to its position in the galaxy. So, I mean, everything is cyclic. Everything is in a circular or orbital path. And, our position now, let's say from the standpoint of the zodiac, we are moving, every 30 degrees around the galaxy changes the sign. Therefore, it changes the frequency, and whatever's coming out from the central sun of our galaxy, it also affects all the extremities of the solar systems within that galaxy. So as our solar system, which is on one of the outer peripheries of the Orion arm of the galaxy, it changes. It will, we are coming into the golden age, I believe, soon, and this is evident in the changing sun. I read an article yesterday that said that, I'm from Louisiana, so there's a lot of hurricanes down in the area. We used to call it Hurricane Alley, and we used to have 4, 5, 6 hurricanes a year come through my neighborhood. This year, there was zero, and this is the first time, let's say, in the last 45 or 50 years, this is the lowest hurricane season in the Gulf, U.S. Gulf area, in the past 50 years. And I'm saying, this is a sign, man.
It could be, Calvin. That might be the government messing around with the HERP weather modification program.
I'm not sure that's true. They can do some things, but let me tell you, they're not as powerful as our sun. They're not as powerful as the solar system that's moving constantly. It has to do with the positioning of us within our galaxy, and also our relationship to the sun, which, the sun is a pump. The central sun is the pump. I think one thing that most sun gazers will realize pretty quick is when they look at the sun, this thing is like vibrating. I mean, it's vibrating at a certain frequency. It's in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out at a very high frequency, but it's pumping. And every intake is pulling all the information from the central sun and the solar system and all the planets into itself, and then it throws it back out again. And it's pumping in, pumping out. That's why when we send intentions to the sun, it's also pumping in what we send it, and it's in magnifying it, tenfold, 20-fold, 40-fold, 100-fold. It's pumping it back out after it's energized it.
It's so, basically like a macrocosm then of our chakra system, right?
Excuse me?
So you could say like the sun and the planets are sort of a macrocosm of our own chakra system.
It's all in the same pattern. And I think we're going to be going through some very interesting times very soon, if they're not already here. It's interesting to watch how this is all unfolding. But believe me, the government's not in control. Something much larger than the government is in control.
Well, Calvin, I'm with you on that. I being here in Japan most of the time, though, I can say there have been a lot of typhoons this year, and they've almost all tended to head towards Fukushima. which is interesting because, you know, so many people argue that the weather is really based on electrical currents, mostly from the sun, but then also, you know, in this case, maybe the massive radiation, you know, radiation is an electrical phenomenon too, the ionization.
So possibly,
I mean, it's certainly been deader than a doornail over on the Atlantic Gulf Coast side of North America, but then, you know, maybe, who knows, maybe it's been extra energy came over towards the Pacific side. I'm not quite sure about that, but for sure the sun, solar spots and everything, it's really dramatically different than normal. So we're in quite a period here.
When I was in Saudi Arabia, for example, when I would sit and watch the evening sun, you know, the sun has an equator, it has a pole, it has a north and south pole, and they rotate at different rates, and that's what's interesting. You know, I would watch the sunspots move across the sun. It takes 11 days if they're in the southern hemisphere or the northern hemisphere. It takes about 28 days for them to move across the sun if they're near the equator. So it's interesting to watch that there are very few sunspots right now.
Almost none, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess the question is, going forward, what do you think this means? I mean, do you think we're entering, are we heading towards kind of a climax of, I don't know what you would say, some good influences, good forces coming out, and some of the bad ones being driven down?
Well, it's all regulated by the spheres that are circulating near and around us. The sun being the primary one that we should be interested in, but each of the planets, but also, I think occasionally, those, shall we say, God or the eternal force out there will send something through our system which will alter things. You know, if we're not going the right way, I mean, you take, for example, this previous comet that was supposed to come through. I don't know, what was the name of it?
ISON?
Not ISON, not that one, the one before. Anyway, it got close to the sun, and the sun shot out a blast of flare that broke that thing up and almost, I mean, disintegrated it within seconds. And, I mean, the SOHO is sitting out there watching this. By the way, I want to say something about that, too. And that is, you know, most people think the sun is very, very hot. I think we discussed this last time you visited Hong Kong. And that is that the sun is not hot. The sun is just an electrical light, as we'll say. And it's not hot. It's cool. That's why they can sit a satellite up there next to it, and it doesn't burn up, you know. I mean, most people, they don't think this deeply, but, you know, if the sun is so hot, how could they fly a rocket up there and place a satellite very close to it to watch everything that's going on the surface of the sun? It should burn up, right? No, the sun is not hot. What makes the sun appear hot is our atmosphere. And here's a test everybody can do. And that is take a piece of paper, put it in your microwave oven, and turn it on for a minute and see what happens. Now, a plain piece of paper, nothing will happen. Now, take that piece of paper and wet it. And then put it in your microwave oven, turn it on for a minute, and you'll start a fire. It's not the microwaves that are hot. It's what they do to the moisture. Now, we feel the sun's heat because That light is coming, that microwave light is coming through an atmosphere which is very moist. And so when it comes through, it heats up, and that's what keeps the Earth warm. It's the atmosphere. It's not the light of the sun. The light of the sun is cool. It's not hot.
Well, along with that, you know, that's kind of sounding like Eric Dollard and some other theorists out there. Do you think that outside from a distance, in other words, not from the Earth, but from far away, is the sun even visible? Do you think? Yeah, I don't know. But I mean, it is conceivable because, like you said, the heat is really a localized thing because we have so much water all around us.
That's true. And it is the moisture in the atmosphere which gives the effect that the sun is hot, but it's actually not hot. It's just a light. It's a light that's sending out microwaves, and those microwaves heat up the Earth when they hit the moisture in the atmosphere.
Well, I just would like to hear what, you know, Tesla had a vision about what the sun was. I just wonder what that vision was. You know, that story where he kind of was on the bench catatonic for 15 minutes and then he realized what the sun was. That story is kind of famous. I'd like to see that. Let's see. Are there any other things we ought to get in here about the sun? This is such a fascinating topic. Do you happen to feel like Professor McCanny that this electrical phenomenon means that comets could be dangerous because of, like, the bug zapper effect? You know, are we moving into an area in space where we have to be worried that more and more asteroids or comets or things like that might have a big effect on us?
Well, you know, the sun is like a big magnet, and it's pulling things in. It's our atmosphere also that disintegrates most of these things as they come through it. And I guess if whatever's headed toward us is large enough, it can break through. I don't know what to think about if you're making reference to ISON or not, but.
No, actually, he's not. He's just saying that all of the legends in history about comets being omens and things in the sky and all that, they're actually true because, first of all, comets are not made of ice. That has nothing to do with it, right? It's the electrical effect. And
exactly.
That, it's something like the Grand Canyon is a lightning strike, in other words. And
well, I'm a believer in the expanding Earth theory, and this will bring us into the topic of the Ormus too. You know,
okay.
I posted something on the Ormus Facebook page the other day, and somebody thought I was an absolute idiot for doing it, because the question was, what is Ormus? And I said it's particle sunlight. You know, we know from Einstein that energy E equals MC squared. Now, you can, you know, transpose algebraically that formula, and you'll find out that actually energy has mass. And that's been proven because radio signals can be bent by the gravity of certain celestial bodies like the moon and slowed down because of the curvature of that transmission. So Einstein was right in that respect, and that is that energy actually has mass. We also know that energy can express itself either as a wave or as a particle. And so all this light that comes through the Earth from the stars, from the sun, from the central sun, eventually particleized and come to the Earth. If you're a believer in the expanding Earth theory.
Oh, I happen to be. The Neil Adams has those great videos on YouTube.
Yeah, well, that pretty well explains it. But, you know, it takes a number of millennia, we'll say, for the Earth to collect enough of these particles of sunlight, which I call ormus, to gather on the earth. I read an estimate somewhere like 20 billion tons of this, materialized light is on the surface. It's like a centimeter of new material that's deposited on the earth every year. And so, as it builds up and builds up, it gets heavier and heavier and heavier. It forces itself down into the earth as more layers are deposited on top of it. And therefore, it has to go somewhere. Therefore, we have the volcanoes that, eject some of the pressure from below. And also, the earth itself expands. Hence, we have these sinkholes. Hence, we have this crack like the one that appeared in Portugal and Spain that went for over 10 miles where there was a huge crack. It was like a miniature Grand Canyon. And so, I don't believe that the Colorado River made the Grand Canyon. I was just there back this past May. I believe that the river found the crevice. If you look at the walls of the Grand Canyon, you'll see the layering effect, the sedimentary layering, which they say was deposited by Lake Bonneville, millions of years ago. I don't believe that. Where is that material coming from? It's coming from the sky. The earth is collecting it in the form of particle sunlight. Therefore, the earth is getting heavier. It's getting larger. It expands. And these cracks that appear in the earth, these sinkholes that appear, these volcanoes that erupt, they're all a result of the tremendous new pressure that accumulates on the Earth's surface.
Well, I'm with you on the expanding Earth idea. It seems quite reasonable. But getting to the Ormus as this kind of light particle, then as a practical matter, what does it turn into? So when we gather Ormus, for example, from seawater or something, what are we actually doing? How are we getting it?
Well, before we get into that, let me just say that, while I was in Saudi Arabia, I also started looking into this Ormus stuff, and I began looking into David Hudson. I left Saudi Arabia in 94, and he actually, showed his writings and his patent and all that around 95 or 96. Anyway, I joined the Science of the Spirit Foundation because I have relatives that live in Phoenix area, in Mesa, while visiting over there, I was reading these stories about him, and so I got very interested in that, and I began trying to make Ormus back in those days, and the first Ormus I ever made was with dew, and it's in the air. That's why I say that Ormus is actually particle sunlight. That's why, in my company, Tibetan Gold, we call our basic Ormus products liquid sunlight because I believe that's what it is. And you can make it out of dew, which is actually, the moisture from the air, and there is stuff in it. And this stuff is Ormus. Or it's a monatomic, it's a single atom form of light, which is a condensed particle of energy. And that's why it has interesting effects upon the human body when you take it, because it's full of light. Barry Carter says that it's like the bridge between the material and the physical world. Well, if the material world is physical, then the spiritual world is electrical. It's the spiritual world is the energy out there before it becomes material. And if you decline light, like let's say light coming from the sun, it gradually slows down and slows down and slows down and eventually impacts the Earth, it's still something. And as Einstein said, that something, that energy, turns into mass. And that mass, I believe, is enormous.
Okay. And then in as a practical matter, the stuff that we see on the market, different people making it, is most of it from seawater, or like in your case, you use what, Tibetan lakes? What do you tend to go with?
Well, you know, I went to school in Utah, so I was near and around the Great Salt Lake a while, and I have extracted ormus from Salt Lake water. I was in Jordan many times and went and got water from the Dead Sea and salt from the Dead Sea, so I made ormus from that. I lived in Southern California for a while, so I got some water from the Salton Sea. And I've made ormus from just about everything you can think of, any kind and every kind of salt. And when I first came to Hong Kong, I was reading that there were several, not several, there's hundreds of small salt lakes throughout the Gobi Desert and also in the eastern Himalayas in Tibet. And, you know, I was bound and determined to find the best source for natural ormus that could be found. And so a friend of mine who's Chinese and speaks both Mandarin and Cantonese, he's an electrical engineer educated at Berkeley in California. We decided to take a trek. You know, we put on our Indiana Jones clothes and flew up to Garimu, which is like the last Chinese city before you enter Tibet. And we rented a four-wheel drive vehicle, and we decided we would explore some of these lakes that are in the eastern Himalayas in Tibet. And so we did, and we went around to a good number of them, and I took samples from all these different lakes. Some of them are more concentrated than others, but we found one particular location where the water was kind of a yellowish, bluish color, and looked down in the lake, and they had crystals, salt crystals, that were like 10, 12 feet tall. You know, salt crystals standing up in the bottom of this lake, and took samples of that and found that after deriving, I took my chemistry kit with me and derived ormus from it. And wow, I couldn't believe how prolific some of this water was with natural ormus. And then as I did more research, I realized that, you know, here's an area that's about 15 to 16,000 feet in altitude. This is a high arid region in the prefecture of the southern prefecture of the Gobi Desert. And what happens is the snow melt, or what we call glacial melt, goes down into these little lakes in the spring. But then they have about 9 months of just no clouds. I mean, it's, you know, 15,000, almost 3,000 or 3 miles high in the sky with intense sunlight that evaporates all the fresh water out of it, and it just leaves the mineral content of this glacial milk in there, and it's been doing this for millions of years. And so, you know, we tested water on the surface a little bit further down and then at depth. And if you pull the water from depth, you get a water that's like 1.5 times the weight of natural water. And the difference is it's full of minerals, monatomic minerals. I mean, the water is as clear as a bell, But when you treat it and derive the ornaments from it, wow, you get 400, 500, 600% more ornaments out of it. It's more than double what you get out of the Dead Sea. I found the most concentrated salt water and the oldest salt water on planet Earth. And so that's what we use as our base source material for the ornaments that we make at Tibetan Gold.
Okay, that sounds good. I've used it and I like it. I guess it's a good point to mention that you have a company and a website, and it's Tibetan-Gold.com, right?
No dash. It's just Tibetan.
No dash? Okay. Okay. Let's see, going on with the Ormus then. So you went there and you found that, and you also, I think you sell like an extracting kit, don't you?
Well, I mean, the first time I went, I brought back maybe 20 or 30 liters. But then when I realized how good this stuff was, I went back up and I hired a trucking company out of Lhasa in Tibet to haul a dozen 440-liter barrels. I have to be careful how I say this, but anyway, we brought it from Lhasa to Shenzhen, which is near Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've seen your big barrels, so you've got quite a supply.
Yeah. Well, you've seen some of them.
Well, yeah, exactly. How do you recommend people use Ormus, and what do you think are the most common effects that you see when people start using it?
Well, this is something I should have said earlier, but when I first made Ormus myself, and being an avid sun gazer, I recognized the effects that sun gazing has upon the human body. And the first time I sampled Ormus, I got the same feelings internally, like being filled with light, that I got when I was sun gazing. And that also is part of the reason why I realized that this Ormus material, these monatomic minerals that are in nature, are actually a form of light, condensed light. And so it was the effects that the Ormus had upon my personal self that made me realize that, hey, this is some good stuff. We need to take a look into this. I think my website was, I put up maybe the third or fourth one, marketing Ormus. But the point that I got to was that, you know, I started making this stuff, and then I would share it with friends, and after a while they said, hey, I want some more of that, you know. And it got to the point where, you know, I was just making it for everybody. And then I said, I got to, you know, start recouping. You know, it costs me a few thousand dollars every time I go to Tibet to extract some of this water. And then the transportation costs to get it 3,000 miles from there to here, it can be expensive. So I decided I would start marketing it. So I put up a website. We had a few products in the beginning, but there wasn't enough Ormus sales to make any difference. So we added a line of curative teas. I became very interested in the Chinese curative effects of many of their teas. The curative effects of many of the Chinese teas. So we have a website that also markets curative teas. We try only to have teas that make some curative effect on the body. But anyway, when I set up the website, there were, you know, very, very few sales. But over time, it's gradually grown and grown and grown. And I would say we're probably one of the largest marketers of Ormus worldwide. We shipped over 65 countries now. And I mean, it's still a small business, but our name is getting out there. We've now had the website up for about almost, I guess, about 9 or 10 years.
Mm-hmm. And you also, of course, sell white powder gold, right? I mean, we're getting into...
Yes.
There's a line where you go from Ormus into white powder gold, and you, as you said, I guess you have relatives in the Phoenix area, so Dave Hudson and all that.
Yes, and I studied extensively the material of David Hudson and what he was trying to do. I know David Hudson. I've met him. I've got pictures made with him, but... I would say that, you know, there's two forms of Ormus. That is, that's from nature. And you can also alchemically reproduce it from ingot metals. You know, the platinum group of metals on the periodic chart, most of those can be made into white powder gold. Now, it's interesting that, you know, the term white powder gold, there's some people selling. I know there's a guy on Facebook that sells it. He's selling 15 grams of it for about $40. But, you know, that is not white powder gold. That has to be made from salt. In other words, natural. Whereas we make products using the David Hudson formula or slight variations thereof. By the way, David Hudson's a businessman. He didn't reveal everything chemically. Now, my background is chemistry and physics, so I know what he left out in his patent. Anybody can go on the internet and read the David Hudson patent for this, which gives a prescription of exactly how to derive Ormus. In other words, to back engineer nature from the metals, you know, getting back to this expanding earth theory where these particles come to the earth and they get forced down into the earth. All these minerals, all of these elements that are on the periodic table, they started out as this materialized sunlight, but then they, under various conditions of heat and pressure, they form into these different materials. Now, what an alchemist does is he takes these things and back engineers them back to the original white powder or the original ormus. Now, there's a difference between what David Hudson made and what nature makes, and that is that, you know, you can take gold, ingot gold, let's say 99.999 pure gold, and you can break it down into its monatomic state. And so during the past 6 years, I've been doing that. So we have both the natural ormus and we have the back-engineered monatomic made from pure gold. If you make it from, let's say, seawater or from Dead Sea salt or Dead Sea water or some of these other things, you're going to get a variety of minerals in it. Most of them, they used to call it C11, SEA, meaning that there were identifiable about 11 different minerals in that. You know, it could be some platinum, some palladium, some osmium, some gold, some silver, some any of the 11 or 12 platinum group metals. That's what nature gives you. But if you make it from pure gold, then you actually do create pure monatomic white powder gold. And we do eight varieties. We do copper and palladium and platinum. Iridium, rhodium, and so, you know, these can be made directly from the pure metals, and you know then that this is pure gold, or it's pure platinum, or it's pure iridium. It's not some mixture of 11 different ones being called white powder gold. There is no, I can tell you for sure, at the price of gold and iridium and rhodium these days, there's no way you could sell 15 grams of this stuff if you made it from the pure metals. And what's being marketed by some people as white powder gold, where they sell you 15 grams of it, I can assure you it's not white powder gold made from pure gold.
Hmm. Well, I guess I have a question. A lot of us, a lot of the listeners are going to be familiar with the general idea of Hudson and what he found and his background and so on and so forth. But I guess what many of us don't know is how have things changed, let's say, in the last 10 years? What have we found out now, or what's new now that we didn't know, let's say, 10 years ago?
Well, I would think from an anecdotal point of view, we know the stuff works. You know, I mean, when David Hudson first revealed that this white stuff in his soil was actually concentrated iridium, rhodium, and gold, people thought he was crazy until he spent $5-6 million proving that, yes, it is. It's just in a different state, okay? People said he was, crazy because he was getting the stuff out of dirt. He's a farmer, you know. I mean, his grandfather was the Secretary of Agriculture for the state of Arizona for a good number of years. So, you know, he's basically a farmer, and that's his training. But he was willing, being a successful farmer, to spend the money to determine whatever it took to find out what in the heck is this white stuff that keeps oozing up out of his soil and making it almost virtually impossible to grow certain crops there. And so what we've learned is that David Hudson was right, and that this stuff does occur naturally in nature. Now, that part of Arizona where he's from, I think one of his biggest farms where he discovered this stuff is actually near Yuma. I mean, you're talking about desert, but it's volcanic desert. If anybody's ever driven through, you know, parts of New Mexico and Arizona there, that's volcanic area. This stuff was created by the eruption of volcanoes many years ago and deposited all this material on the ground. And so we know that David Hudson was right, that this stuff is out there in nature. David Hudson, though, decided, well, if this is gold, if this is iridium, if this is rhodium that's in his soil, can you actually take a piece of metallic gold and make this stuff? And can you take, metallic iridium and make this stuff? And he through his patent, proved that, yes, you can. In other words, he duplicated what nature was doing and actually made a purer form of, he called it orme, which is orbitally rearranged monatomic elements. Okay, orme, we have hence used the word more, ormus. And so he found that you could actually duplicate nature by back engineering the metal into this stuff that he found in his ground. And we also know through many experiments that he did in the medical profession and contracts he had with certain pharmaceutical companies that, yes, this stuff actually does work and has major healing effects on lots of things. Not just on the physical, but also the psychological, so that ormus, has a calming effect. It has an effect of enlightening people. I mean, there's quite a few effects that it has. I would recommend anybody interested in learning more about ormus, they get in, look up Google Chris Emmons, who wrote a book. It's kind of like the definitive Ormus manual called Ormus. And it describes how to make it. I mean, I know Chris. She's from Florida. And she spent years putting together all the different ways that people have been making Ormus. And she does a good job in a very professionally done work that people can study more about Ormus.
Hmm. Sounds good. Sounds good. Now, for those who are interested in taking variations of the white powder gold, what would you suggest? How should they go about learning? I mean, they have different traits, right? Iridium, platinum. There's,
yes,
you have like there's red powder gold, right? There's white powder
yes.
gold.
Can you hold just a second?
Okay.
Come plug it. Get your charger and plug it. Come plug in. Recharge your laptop.
Is it cut off?
Not yet, but it's getting close. So plug it down or something.
I'm sorry for the interruption, but I'm having to plug in the laptop because the battery is about to go out.
Oh. Hey, Calvin, how much longer can you go? We don't want to...
No, I'm fine now.
We don't want to wear you out.
No, I'm fine now. I'm good to go.
So another 30 minutes is okay?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Restate your last question, and I'll get into that.
Okay, so I'll start over. It was about the different types and how do people.
Oh
get
yeah,
going.
Okay.
We're going to edit all this out. So let me just restate it in case this is helpful for the editor. So Calvin, there are all these different kinds of white powder gold, red powder gold, platinum, iridium. How can people learn about them to decide which ones they might want to try?
Well, on my website, I've done the best I can to delineate all the available information about the effects of these various minerals on the human body. So if they want a quick reference as to, you know, if they have a particular ailment, they can do a search on my website, say for diabetes, for example, or for high blood pressure or whatever, then my website gives information about how each of these various non-metallic, monatomic elements can assist in healing. Now, that's on the Tibetan Gold website. But you mentioned red powder gold. I'll speak about gold because it's of all the elements on the periodic table, it's quite unique, and I suppose that's why it relates so well and has always been referred to as the metal of the sun. I mean, the alchemical symbol for gold is the same as the sun. It is the metal of the sun, as copper would be for Venus or lead for Saturn. But,
Calvin?
Yes, I'm here.
May I interject something here? In line with Plain's question. I know you probably can't remember this, but I had a very profound experience the very first time I took anything Ormus. It was back in 2003. I was in a great deal of pain, and I had to have something real strong, real fast. And so the alchemist that I was working with at that time started me out on something weaker, but not quite weak enough. I had very I had a lot of trouble adjusting, okay? And so where I'm going with this is that for the novice, would you not suggest that someone start out with some of the lesser precipitates made from salt rather than going straight for the metals?
Yes, I generally do recommend that. In fact, we state that on our website that, you know, if you're new to Ormus, you probably should start with the basic product, because the white powder gold or white powder palladium or platinum or whatever made directly from the metals, it does have a much stronger effect. It's more intense, and it's for the more experienced user. It's also a bit more expensive. So, you know, if you want to start out light, use the less expensive products. But you're right about that. That, you know, I would say that a person who's never used these materials to start out light, just like you would if you were sun gazing for the first time, you know, you do it, you build your body up to it. Now, there's additional reasons for that, and that is that the body, well, let's say that years ago when we ate, you know, our vegetables or whatever from the garden, you know, our soils were very, very rich in these minerals, and we got them through the foods we eat. But nowadays, with this industrialized mechanical farming that is being done, these people just put nitrogen and ammonia-type fertilizer on the ground, and they're not really getting the basic materials or minerals that used to be in all the soils of the earth. In other words, they have depleted most of the beneficial effects. Yes, they can produce a beautiful-looking tomato, but it tastes like pith. It tastes like paper. You know, it doesn't have any nutritive substance to it. They can produce lots of beautiful-looking vegetables and things, but they're not healthy for you.
Yeah.
So you can overcome this by putting back into your body the things that, you know, traditionally were there but are no longer available to us. And most people are eating all these junk food type things, and they certainly are chemically based rather than nutritive based. And so we call these, I hate to use the word supplements, but they're, you know, we call them health minerals. We have to be very careful with the FDA because, you know, you can't say you can cure anything. You can't say that you give medical advice of any kind. So we have to be very careful in how we express this stuff. But we do know that these things do, in fact, replenish the body. But, you know, whenever you're depleted with something and then you take a big amount of something, it's going to be a shock to the body because it hasn't had it in a while. Or maybe ever. And so, you know, the effects you are having are evidence of that. And there's something called the, you know, a healing crisis. Some people, when they first take this, if they take, you know, the wrong amount or the wrong quantity in the beginning, then it's going to be a shock to the body and they're going to feel a bit ill. In fact, I was recently talking to someone who said that you know, this was the effect. And I said, well, then, you know, back off a little bit, take less, and let your body build up. Because, you know, too much goodness all of a sudden will make you feel uneasy or uncomfortable. It's not that your body is rejecting this stuff. It's just it's not accustomed to it. And so,
I can definitely attest to that.
Yeah, and this is not uncommon. I mean, anybody who, you know, I mean, I'm not an advocate of chemotherapy, but I have relatives who have undergone it. And the same thing happens when, you know, they force these chemotherapy solutions into the body. Man, your hair falls out. You know, you feel sick, you can't walk. I mean, and what your body is experiencing is a shock. So, I mean, I don't think people should ever be worried about taking hormones. There's nothing harmful in it. And that's
another thing we've learned
over years is that no one has ever been harmed by taking Ormus. It's just like no one has ever lost their eyesight from sun gazing.
Yeah, I don't mean to make it sound dangerous. It is just so life-changing that that can be really hard to deal with.
Hmm. Well, I didn't find it quite that dramatic.
It was for me.
It may be the strength, what you were trying. I mean, maybe, you know, most people start with smaller amounts or whatever, and then... I guess, as Calvin said earlier, you know, he has more of a impetuous personality. I mean, where you like attack things aggressively as opposed to putting your toes in and seeing how the water feels.
Well, that's the situation I was in. I was in a desperate situation, and I had to jump in, and it wasn't fun, but it did work.
Mm. Yeah, well, I mean, after experiencing the healing crisis for a few days or a week or so, it's like what happened to me when I had the situation with the sun gazing too much, too quickly, and not moving my eyes around. You know, I was blinded for a few days, but you know, after I overcame that, it was better than ever.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, hey, I got a bit of a question there earlier. So in a sense, there was a question about how would somebody know what to start with? And then, Calvin, you mentioned that on your website you have a lot of information about this is more effective for diabetes or something like that. But I guess one question would be, is there something that you could just take as an experiment for general purposes?
Well, I would recommend our Golden Emperor Liquid Sunlight because it's not only the least expensive, it's also quite mild, and you know, it will kind of initiate you into the use of Ormus, and you realize in a few days that you've got a lot more energy than you had before, that you sleep better, that you have more lucid dreaming. I mean, I've had a couple of authors write to me and say, man, I took that stuff and man, you know, I had writer's block for 3 months and all of a sudden, man, I can't quit writing. So I know this stuff works. I have hundreds and hundreds of anecdotal stories, people telling me the experiences they've had with it. So, you know, I'm very pleased to be involved in something that I know is actually doing some good for people.
Mm-hmm. Well, with that in mind, with the you go to conferences, right? I mean, people who are interested could find out more at some of these alchemy conferences, right?
Yes, I attended 3 of them this year, and you know, speaking in the United States. It's a gathering of people who both produce and use Ormus, and we invite the general public to these. They're trying to put another one together in February, but I don't have any information on that right now. But usually in the summer just at the beginning or the end of summer, we have these gatherings, and each time they're growing a bit. So I was also at the conference in Washington, in Redmond, Washington, put on by
Robert Bartlett.
Yeah, Robert Bartlett. They make Ormus, or they make, let's say, something similar to Ormus, or I guess you could call it Ormus, but they make it from plants. It's where they derive the absolute essences from various types of plants. It's a branch of alchemy called spagyrics. And we're on the mineral side. They're on the plant or the plant side. So both have the same goal in mind, and that is to create the essences of these minerals that are in plants or in nature, and how to use them to best heal the body.
Yeah, we interviewed Robert Bartlett not that long ago, and he's quite an interesting fellow. You can learn a lot about certainly alchemy, which is his, you know, his field. But there are these conferences. I guess they're typically on the West Coast. But for anybody interested in these, they can do a search for them. And as you said, Calvin, you attended several of them.
Yeah, there were three of them this year. And then, you know, a year ago or so, it was in near Atlanta, Georgia, in Enota. So, they're getting to be more and more of these. So if people who are interested in Ormus, finding out more about it, you know, they're welcome to attend these. And if they want to get on one of the Ormus forums or the Ormus Facebook page or keep up with me, I send out a newsletter from time to time with various sales and also information about these conferences to all the people who are registered members of my website.
Mm-hmm.
And I might just mention too that we just began a 2-for-1 special on all of our monatomic and Ormus products. So if people want to try this out, now's a good time to do it because we have this new special that is going on for the next 40 days, so that they can get 2 for the price of 1. That's a 50% discount on all of our products.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope some people take advantage of that. Moving on, Uriel, have you got any questions? Haven't heard from you lately.
I guess I'm a little confused about what Ormus really is. I mean, I understand what he's been talking about, but there's still some vagueness in my mind about what exactly it is. I mean, why is it different than just mineral supplements?
Okay, well, you have to get into the alchemical understanding of what this is, I would believe. Now, you know, it's my opinion that this originates as sunlight. And when the sunlight comes to Earth, the Earth will, because of various locations, weather conditions, the heat and pressure and time, create the various minerals of the periodic table. Now, Ormus used to be in all of our soils. And so when people, you know, eat fruits or the bounty of the land, they would naturally get these things. Nowadays, most of our food is mass-produced. It is lacking in the basic minerals that are available naturally, but have been leached out of the soil by over-farming and mass-farming. So this is a way of putting those minerals. By the way, the biggest alchemical retort in our universe is the Earth itself. You know, it is producing all these minerals from light. But once they've been leached out of the soil, you know, I mean, I guess these industrial farmers do the best they can to, you know, keep the crops growing, but they don't do it with all the stuff. There's a branch of the Ormus community that isn't totally involved in farming, by the way. I mean, you put this stuff in the soil, and it, you know, Barry Carter will show you walnuts that are the size of grapefruits because they will magnify the production of food. This is a way of ending the world food shortage, by the way. Every time Ormus is used in the soils beneath the plants, the prolific yields that they're getting with it. I mean, this is nature's fertilizer. These plants love it as well. But I mean, if you don't want to go through the eating of the stuff which has been grown in Ormus soil, then you can actually supplement your own diet with these minerals from the beginning, and that's what we make. That's what we produce. We make 11 or 12 different varieties of these things.
Well, Uriel, I'd add that talking about Ormus, I mean, I think Calvin talked about this book, right? From,
yeah.
Did you say Chris in Florida or something?
Yeah, Chris
they have Emmer. They have these different techniques, like from seawater or from types of soil, and I guess like from, you know, lake beds and things. And I mean, it's kind of like you're extracting some essential essence from these materials, but I can't really do justice to it. But what I can say for sure is, again, as Calvin mentioned, if you look at Barry Carter, who's quite famous in this world, if his website and others who've done Ormus experiments, you really do get, for example, fruits or vegetables that are twice as big and incredibly tastier when you use this. And some people say that it's just the minerals, right? Everything is lacking in minerals. But I don't think so, because if you just added mineral supplementation, you wouldn't get remotely the kind of results you get.
And the reason for that is because the Ormus itself actually contains energetic light. So, I mean, it has not only a nutritive effect, but I think it has an enlightening effect upon the body.
Anyway, that's my take as well. I mean, I can't necessarily prove this, but I think there's a more fundamental or spiritual kind of thing to it than just a mechanistic, you know,
yeah.
You know, the body doesn't have enough of some, you know, mineral or something, iodine. Now, not changing the fact, though, that a lot of Americans with the food supply today are totally deprived of minerals, right? So if they just got those basic minerals, they'd feel a lot better. That's true, too. But I don't think you'd see these plants and trees and all, you know, grow to be twice as big. Okay, well, let's get back to the white powder gold a little bit. So, Daddy Bob, you had these dramatic experiences. Are you still using any white powder gold?
Well, I've never actually taken white powder gold by that name. I have taken some very strong elixirs from a certain alchemist, and I've got some of Calvin's iridium elixir here right now, but I can't claim that I've actually taken white powder gold.
Oh, okay.
And what I have taken is an elixir of gold, iridium, and rhodium, and it was extremely potent.
Okay.
When you asked the question about what's the difference between red and white powder gold, and I started to explain that of all the elements in the periodic table, gold is probably the most unique, and that's because, like our planets, you know, all the moons on those planets and the planets themselves rotate in a certain direction, except for one of them. Actually, it's Venus. And Venus rotates opposite of all the other planets. And Neptune also slightly, it's tilted. But gold, among the elements, it has a right-hand spin to its to the orbits of its electrons. And we're not sure what shape the nucleus of a gold atom is. So when you're working alchemically with gold metal, it does interesting things. And if a person will study anything about alchemy, you know there's various stages of alchemy that it goes through, and one of those is the peacock's tail. And what that means is the element will express itself in various colors, and gold does this. And as you're refining it into the monatomic state, once it gets into the monatomic state, it turns red. And alchemists in the past have always called this the sorcerer's stone, okay? If you fan like my daughters are of the Harry Potter series. One of the episodes was Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. And in that, it showed that the Sorcerer's Stone was red. But then the alchemist tries to create what is called the Philosopher's Stone, which is white. And so as you are performing the alchemical processes on this metallic gold and breaking it down from its state of, what is it, 79 atoms in a gold molecule, and you break those 79 atoms down into individual monatomic atoms, first it turns red, and then over a period of time and extra heat, it will turn white. Okay, and that is what is called the Philosopher's Stone. Now, in our processing, we find that some people like the red form and some people like the white form. And what I have found is the difference is how it affects the body. The red powder gold is more of a physical. You feel it more physically, whereas the white one you feel more etherically or spiritually. It increases consciousness quite a bit more, and the red one has very pleasant physical effects upon the body. So they're both monatomic forms of gold. And by the way, gold is the only one that goes through that color process like that, and that's because of the spin of its electrons.
Well, that's interesting. Well, I have some experience taking white powder gold, and also in the past, I even took, there's a pharmaceutical product that's just colloidal gold, because that improves mental performance. It's been tested, and I don't know, in an IQ test, you might go up 10 or 15 points if you take this colloidal gold that's expensive. It's not the stuff you might get in a health food store. It's actually the real deal, and it's expensive. And with the white powder gold, I found it to be much more like it improves your intuition.
Yes, exactly.
And I mean, it's kind of like, you know, before you open a door, you know what's on the other side would be more the feeling.
It's much more, spiritual in its effects, the white powder, whereas the red powder. If you want better mental acuity, like memory, then that's the one you'd want. But if you want more intuitive, spiritual feelings, then you would want the white one.
Yeah, and I'm just saying, from my experience, this is true. This is the case. And so if people are making decisions based on that, for whatever it's worth, I can say that. You definitely get a more intuitive feeling of what's coming, what's around the door. I mean, it's almost like you might even have this feeling like what's about to happen. But anyway, it's definitely more along those lines, etheric or whatever you want to call it. And then the red is much more like a general health elixir or something.
Yeah, does that answer his question?
Well, it's a start. Let's see, before we wrap it up before too much longer, are we missing any other questions? Oolong, you got any questions for us?
No, not in this area. He's pretty much answered everything I could have asked, I guess, so far. So.
Okay, Daddy Bob, any more?
Calvin, are you familiar with the spice?
Yes, I do. I'm familiar with. I tried some of it this summer, actually, because we were both speakers. I mean, the person that makes that spice, we were both speakers at the same conference. And
was it the person who makes it or the person who distributes it?
The person that makes it.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize he actually went public.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I don't know if he had gone public, but he was giving out samples, And, you know, he also mixes it with water. And we all had a chance to sample it, yeah.
How did you feel about it? I've used it extensively. It's very strong to me.
Yeah, it's very strong. And, if you like it, fine. I use so much of my own stuff that, I'm very accustomed to it. And so I don't usually sample other people's stuff because I am very convinced that my stuff is the best for me. And I have had extremely good results with it in all areas and aspects of my life. So I'm not much into using other people's things.
Okay.
Though I try them.
Well, Daddy Bob, are you aware of any other results? I mean, I watched a video where the guy who makes it was talking about it. I mean, is there something you want to mention?
No, I was just trying to get his take on the spice. The spice has made a big splash in the Ormus world in the last year or two. And so I just thought he might have some comment on it. That's all. I have used it. It helped me deal with my grief, but I don't really want to take us there right now.
Mm. Okay. Well, I haven't tried it yet, but one of these years. Let's see if we have any other things we wanted to get into. Calvin, are there any topics that we might have covered but didn't so far?
Well, I wanted to get more into the spiritual alchemy of all of this.
And then let's do
that,
it.
Our purpose in life is to perfect ourselves as best we can. And that has always been one of my primary goals in life, is to find out what's the best way to do this. And the more I study astrology and the alchemy of the human body, the more I realize that we're all involved in a vast alchemical process that's going on at many different levels, from celestial to terrestrial and telestial as well. And we should all be very mindful of that. Now, what I call Ormus, an assist in doing this. You know, a lot of people think, well, yeah, I mean, even I've heard David Hudson say that, you take 3 ounces of this on a after a three-day fast, you take 3 grams of this after a three-day fast, then you will become an angel. And I say, hold on a minute, not so fast, because, no substance in and of itself is going to perfect you, because perfection is a psychological and psychic thing. And, we have a right brain and a left brain. It's the yin and the yang of the body. We have these chakras that are going through our body, and we have the Ida and the Pingala intertwined streams of energy that are going up and down our body. And we need to learn about this alchemical process that's going on within ourselves, and that our own advancement and perfection and development is very dependent upon our understanding of ourselves. You know, the oracle of Delphi said, man, know thyself, and you will then understand the universe and God. It wasn't just man, know thyself. It was more, and that is, you must understand your inner alchemy so that you may perfect yourself and become like unto a God. And so we need to be advancing in that direction. Now, Ormus is a way of assisting us in that, because, as you said, when you take the white powder gold, or any of these Armas products, it does give you much more intuition and a much higher consciousness. That's why I'm in this business. And that's why I use my own products continuously, because I see their benefit. And I am trying to work with the inner alchemy within my own being and assist as best I can in this further development by eliminating the darkness, by bringing in more light. Because, you know, we're all going to die. But, you know, energy is indestructible. The energy is not in the flesh. That's only a temporary vehicle. The energy is in the spirit. It is the spirit which enlivens the flesh. And if we can increase the energy levels, the consciousness, therefore, within our own beings, then we will... once we discard this aged vehicle, that energy is not going to die. Whatever we have when we depart is going to be with us. And you know, if we make another go round or if we go somewhere else, that part of you, which is you, is going to remain, and you're going to take that with you. So. You know, it's all about the enlightenment. By the way, I would add one thing here. You know, when I was living in Sri Lanka as a consultant for the UN, I used to, on my weekends, interview these Buddhist monks. The Theravada form of Buddhism is centered in Sri Lanka. And many of these monks are, Oxford educated, so they're very smart guys. And one of the places where I visited, where they had this long reclining Buddha, I happened to ask one of the monks there, I said, do you know whether or not Buddha ever did any sun gazing? And he said, oh, yes, sir. Yes, I know about that. And he told me that Siddhartha Gautama, who became the Buddha, was an avid sun gazer. And that he sun gazed from dawn until dusk every day for the week prior to his enlightenment. And, you know, it was a real revelation to me. And I find that all of these great avatars of the past, whether it be a Krishna from the Vedas or Siddhartha Gautama from the Buddhists or Jesus Christ, in the Christian faith, all of these people were sun gazers, and all of them were involved in, you know, developing the consciousness of the body to the point where when they left, they took with them all of this enlightenment which they had gained here. So many of the people of the world are not involved in this. They're not interested. But I think there are enough of us that are involved in it, that we can actually change the world if we put our minds to it. So, you know, understanding the body, how it works, the alchemical processes that are going on within it, we should all become spiritual alchemists concerning our own selves and our own lives. And if we do that, then the world is going to be a better place, and all the people around us will feel the effects of it.
Yes, and in addition to that, there's kind of the idea that, you take wisdom with you on your next incarnation, right?
Yes, or if you're a fan of Gurdjieff, he calls it the reoccurrence.
Yes, the reoccurrence. The next reoccurrence, you'll
your
be
next
at a...
Your next reoccurrence, you will come back with all that you take with you in this one.
So we'll start at, further along in the race. So there's that incentive, too.
Absolutely.
Well, the spiritual alchemy is a long topic. are there any other suggestions or things that you've discovered over the years? I mean, music, types of, I mean, obviously sun gazing and white powder gold, but any other suggestions or thoughts on that?
Well, it's everything. Everything we do should be done with a mind toward increasing rather than decreasing our health, our mental capacity, our consciousness. You know, it can be in music, you know. I was reading yesterday that the certain frequencies of music do enhance the body. Now, you know, that's like the Monroe Institute, and I know that that is very effective because I've had a relative who's been through that, extremely depressed, but by listening to certain frequencies and tones of music, it changed their life completely. So, yes, music can be an important part of it, but it's the right kind and it's the right frequencies. All of these are assists to help us. You know, it's a constant learning. It's a constant educational effort to learn these things. And, you know, it's like the old German proverb that says, I'm too soon old and too late smart. If we could incorporate these things in our lives at an earlier time among the young people and teach them, then I think the world would be a much better place.
For sure. Let's see. I guess I'm kind of curious with the sun gazing. A lot of people who do it kind of, I don't know how to put it, but it's hard to maintain. You know, you get into your life, you get into your, you're not in a place where you can see the sun, like all the skyscrapers in Hong Kong or something. And then they kind of stop doing it a lot. Do you think you still maintain the benefits? I mean, maybe physically your eyesight, but what about the spiritual side? Is it something that you have to keep up?
I still sun gaze. I mean, I did 20 minutes yesterday, and I will probably do another 20 or 30 minutes today. But I tend to do it more at noonday now rather than early in the morning or in the late afternoon because of the problem with the buildings. You know, I can look off my balcony right here in Hong Kong and I can see 2 million people. What I mean by that is the residents in these high-rise buildings around me. There's 2 million of them, but I have a rooftop. And so I can go up on the rooftop and I can look at the sun, you know, when it's high in the sky. I don't recommend everybody start doing that at noonday because that is the most intense sunlight of the day. It is the most high God, as the Egyptians told it. But I do that. And, you know, rather than standing with my neck craned upward, I use mirrors now. And that's also quite effective. I do that just about every day for a few minutes anyway, just to keep myself topped up. It's like using Ormus, you know, when people first start using Ormus, they want to take a lot of it, and they do usually. And but after a while, you find out that the more you take has less effect. So sunlight is the same way. You know, if you've had, like I did, I had about 3 years of very intensive 3 hours a day sun gazing, and it changed my whole life. But now I just top up. And people do that with Ormus now. After you've gone through a regimen of a year or so and use quite a bit of the Ormus products, then you know you don't have to take so much. You just top up from time to time because you will be a different person, and you will require less because your physical aspects and your mental aspects will have changed.
Well, that's something that's really exciting, actually. Let's see what else we can cover here in spiritual alchemy. I think, do you have any thoughts on some of the more dramatic meditation, you know, the Kundalini and some of those kinds of things?
Well, you know, it's all about the chrism, or you know, it can be translated as the Christ essence within the body. And are you there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. We have to raise this fluid that's in the body, that's actually manufactured in low chakras, and then raise it up to the top. So when I meditate, I am mentally moving these fluids, this energy, this chrism, this Christ energy, up my body. I'm doing that mentally. And I do this every day, and try to bring that energy up to the crown chakra, the pineal gland, and it does have an effect. Over time it gets you into the flow of what's happening in your body, the energy flow, and you have to do this mentally. And you know, when I lay down to either take a nap or retire at night, I try to envision a ball of energy at my toes, and then I mentally move that ball up each leg, and then up the body, up to the crown chakra. And you know, you can actually envision the sun in the middle of your head. And as you do this is a meditation regimen that I personally do, and it's very, very effective. What it actually does is it relaxes your whole body, and the sleep and the lucid dreaming that occurs because you do it is massive. I mean, you really have a relaxing experience every time if you are consistent with doing it. You know, it makes you actually require less sleep because you sleep so soundly, and at the same time, your dreams are extremely lucid and memorable.
It reminds me a little bit of some of the Monroe Institute tapes. They have a lot of these, you know, where you're trying to go on the edge of sleep, and visualization exercises as you're about to get to the deeper levels.
Well, you know, I still have three teenage daughters in my house, and you know, sometimes I say, well, I can't go to sleep. I don't want to go to sleep. And I tell them, now, what you need to do is just relax your body and try to find that spot just before sleep. You know, and that is where you really begin to communicate with the other side. You know, there is a place of total bliss as you're falling asleep. And what you try to do is you try to find that place and hold it there for as long as you can. And that will create the best night's sleep that you've ever had. You'll eventually fall asleep. But that place between waking and sleeping is Eden. You enter the garden right there. So that's a meditative technique that I try. And it really has worked for me.
Well, thanks. That sounds pretty helpful. I think I'm going to give that a shot. Okay, well, Calvin, I think we're moving along on time here, so we're just about ready to wrap it up.
All right.
We very much appreciate your time. And so why don't you give out your website once more?
All right. I can be found at TibetanGold.com. TibetanGold, one word. .com. And I can be contacted at seekverta@tibetangold.com.
Sounds good. We appreciate you coming. It's been very informative. Oolong? Daddy Bob and Uriel, thank you much.
Thanks, Calvin.
You're certainly welcome. Anytime.
I really enjoyed this.
Daddy
Bob, Calvin.
Good to make contact with you again.
Thank you very much, Calvin, and you too.
All right.
So, Calvin, you're going to help some people who hear this. It's going to give a lot of people some ideas. So we do appreciate you coming.
All right.
So that's it. Thanks, everyone. Right. It's a wrap. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.